Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. We aim to feature a variety of guests with roots in the Restoration tradition from Community of Christ and our friends from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.
Welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Katie Langston, and I'm extremely happy that you have joined us today. And I'm very excited because we have a very fun panel assembled for our discussion today. And also kind of excited because today I get to participate not just as a host, but sort of as a member of the panel. So that'll be cool. We are talking about missions and service in sort of formal capacities. And so we have Josh Mangelson, co-host of Project Zion, and then Zach and Katie Harmon-McLaughlin, who are members of Community of Christ, and they're going to be sharing about their own experience in the World Service Corps in Community of Christ and sort of talk about those experiences. So first, let's have everyone just kind of introduce themselves. We'll start with Josh, since most of you probably know him pretty well, as he's one of our co-hosts. Josh, why don't you say hi and just a couple words about yourself for those who might be tuning in new and haven't met you yet.
Hi, I'm Josh Mangelson. I live here in Utah with Brittany. She's also a co-host on Project Zion, and we're members of the Salt Lake City Congregation of Community of Christ.
Awesome. And then, Katie, you've been on an episode or two, I think, of Project Zion. So why don't we go to you next to introduce yourself?
I'm Katie Harmon-McLaughlin, and I work for Community of Christ. My job is spiritual formation specialist, and I live in Walnut Creek, California with Zach.
Awesome. And Zach?
Yes. My name's Zach Harmon-McLaughlin. I am married to this lovely lady named Katie. And I also work for Community of Christ. I'm the Mission Center President for the Sierra Pacific USA Mission Center.
I realize I didn't introduce myself in the same way as everyone else did. So I'm Katie Langston, and I am a student at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. I'm born and raised LDS, but was just confirmed Lutheran on Easter Sunday a couple weeks ago. So that's me. Great. Well, to kind of start out with, maybe we could just sort of each sort of share a little bit about where we served. And then I think what I would love to do is turn it over to Katie and Zach to share a little bit about what the World Service Corps and Community of Christ is and how that works. And then from there, Josh and I can kind of compare and contrast that to the LDS experience. So maybe we can just sort of go around robin and share like where we served, and then Katie and Zach, if you would take a few minutes and just sort of talk to us about the program. So I served my LDS mission in Bulgaria. Josh?
I served my mission in Mexico, Tampico.
Katie?
I served with World Service Corps in India.
India, cool.
I served my World Service Corps time in Zambia.
Wow, okay. So talk about World Service Corps. What is it, and how does it work, and how long are you there, and what do you do, and all that kind of stuff?
I'll give that a go. World Service Corps is a really unique, wonderful opportunity and experience for people of all ages in the Community of Christ. Typically, young adults are the main volunteers, but it's really for anyone at any stage of life to do. You can go on what we call a short-term trip or a long-term volunteer basis. Short-term trips, which is what Katie and I both did, are typically somewhere from the 8 to 10 week range, give or take. And long-term experiences can be from a year to 2 years long, serving in any given place. The main focus of World Service Corps is for cross-cultural experiences within the church. But it also provides a great opportunity to, share in ministry, in different cultures and contexts. So volunteers, that participate in World Service Corps do a number of different things depending on the culture and place in which they serve. Everything from preaching, teaching, peace camps, Bible schools, developing programs for their communities, food pantries, to working with NGOs and local community governments. So it really serves a broad spectrum of needs in the communities and neighborhoods where Community of Christ is present. Uh-huh. So it's a great opportunity that really kind of meets you where you're at and offers you a unique cultural experience that both benefits your life and the place you serve. Katie, do you have anything to add to that?
That sounds good.
Okay. Okay, good.
Well done. So for the most part, it sounds like you guys are serving in areas where, like you said, where Community of Christ already has a presence. Is that correct?
Yes. So okay. I think maybe one of the differences between World Service Corps and an LDS mission is the intention is probably a little bit different, that there's not a sense that you go to try to convert or gain members, but uh-huh. you go as more of, like Zach said, cross-cultural exchange and invitation to practice being Community of Christ in a different place.
Cool. Very, very cool. But is the service for the most part intended to be ecclesiastical in nature? Or are you doing, I mean, I know, Zach, you mentioned like working with NGOs and so on, but is it mostly about like ministry within the Community of Christ congregation? Or is it a good mix of that and like humanitarian work?
I think the main focus is obviously working with local congregations to help them with programming, mission, worship, and community outreach. I think that is probably the main focus. But the really cool thing about World Service Corps is each context, each community is different. So the needs and the desires of that certain congregation, depending on if you're in, you know, San Francisco, California versus Zambia, Africa, you know, the needs there are going to be very different for the churches. And so perhaps in San Francisco, there may not be a need so much for preaching or teaching about the church, but a need to engage congregations in local organizations and local expressions of our faith. Versus yep. if you're in Zambia, Africa, the church may have a higher need for resources and teaching and worship and teaching about the church. So it's very context driven. One of the things I love about World Service Corps is that it's not just for Westerners either, but you know, that folks from all over the world come to the United States and go to Europe and Australia and every continent. So the cross-cultural specific context of World Service Corps is really one of the things that makes it really wonderful.
We actually have a number of volunteers from around the world that come to the Kirtland Temple each year as their World Service Corps assignment.
So how does the assignment process take place for World Service Corps? Do you kind of get to pick where you go, or do you get like, is it like the draft where you get chosen? Like, how does it work?
Well, typically you would work with the World Service Corps director and go through an application process, and you would have an interview as well. And then you can often request if there's a place you'd like to go or if there's a partner that you would like to go with. But during their selection process, they also take into account what the needs of those areas are and what the gifts of the people who have applied are. And they try to match people up in a way that it makes sense for everyone. So sometimes you'll get the place that you requested, and sometimes you might not.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, one of the kind of cool things is that I was going to say something about how, you know, it's really driven by people's skill set. So You know, if you speak Spanish, for example, you know, obviously going to a place where that is a need, but also it's collaborative with the local sites that host these volunteers. So, like me as a Mission Center president, for example, I could reach out to the director of World Service Corps and say, hey, I'd really like to have two volunteers, on a short-term basis. And that would be really great. And the director of World Service Corps would say, great, what are some of the needs? And I could say, I need somebody who speaks Spanish and someone who can really teach about the Bible. And then they would work with the people who have applied to find me the appropriate volunteers for that need.
Cool. And about how old are World Service Corps volunteers?
Typically, World Service Corps volunteers are later in college. So primarily young adults. However, recently there has been an increase in older adults, who are just retiring and looking for, a meaningful way to begin the transition into retirement and continue to serve the church.
Cool. And, do you have to be single, like as a young adult, or can you go as a married couple or
anything like that?
Either or, Zach and I were both single when we did World Service Corps. But actually, the person who is the director of World Service Corps right now, Emily Penrose McLaughlin, she went to Africa with her husband for a year. So
nice.
There's options to do a number of different things.
Cool.
Yeah, that's pretty different from us, huh, Josh?
Yeah, it's really different. I'm just wondering, and I don't want to put you on the spot too much if you don't know, but do you know when that changed? Because I'm thinking that back in, at some point, the RLDS was probably more similar to the LDS church where they went out two by two as mandated in a section in the Doctrine and Covenants, went to specific places for a specific term. And I'm just wondering if you know when that changed.
Well, I don't know exactly. I do think that World Service Corps from its inception has always been more of a cross-cultural exchange. And World Service Corps itself, Zach, do you remember when it started?
I want to say the late 90s. It had a different name before World Service Corps. I don't know. I can't think of off the top of my head what that name was. But since it became World Service Corps, there's never really been. Now they do always go two by two. I can't speak to the scriptural, paradigm of that other than, you know, that's kind of pivotal for the safety of our volunteers and a lot of the places they serve. I'm also a 70 in the church, and I can speak, you know, as far as 70s and real missionary outreach, not that World Service Corps is not that, but we still do practice this idea of sharing and mutual ministry together. It's less assignment driven. And the real, I guess, difference for World Service Corps is that while it is a missionary ministry, it's much more of a mutual experience. There's not the agenda of going to baptize or convert near as much as there is the agenda to try to strengthen, help and benefit the congregations in which you're serving in. So as far as I can remember, though, married couples, single people, just apply and get placed wherever there's a need.
Yeah, awesome.
Very cool.
Well, how much do you guys, I mean, have you ever had a chance to sit down and kind of chat a bit about the LDS experience, mission experience? Like, how much do you know about it?
We don't know a ton. Well, I should speak for myself, not Katie. I don't know a ton. We've certainly encountered a number of, LDS missionaries. We lived in Kirtland for 2 years before we moved here to California. So, obviously there are a lot of missionaries in Kirtland. We've had some really positive experiences and some, more challenging experiences. I have not spent a whole lot of time, learning about that. I've seen some clips from the Book of Mormon musical, but I'm sure that's not.
No.
It's exactly like that. No, it's not exactly like that.
So I will, one funny story, one time was we had some Mormon missionaries visit us and they, they asked to pray with the man of the house, and I asked if Katie wanted to pray instead, and they were kind of surprised by that. But
I love it. That's hilarious slash sad.
Yeah, Katie, why don't you tell us about your mission, though, in Bulgaria? What was that like? When did you serve?
Yeah, sure. So sort of like just some points of differentiation, particularly for you, Zach, if you're not super familiar, and also for some of our Community of Christ listeners. So LDS missionaries serve for 1.5 to 2 years. 1.5 for the young women and 2 years for the young men. When I went back in, I served in 2003 to 2004. Women had to be 21 or older to go, and young men could go at the age of 19. They've recently changed that. Well, in the last few years, they've changed that. And so now young women can go at 19 and young men can go as early as 18. So, they kept the differentiation in terms of how long the service period is. So it's still 2 years for guys and a year and a half for girls. And what happens is you put in your paperwork and they just assign you. Like, you don't really get to say where you'd rather go. You just sort of sign a thing that says you'll go wherever you're called. My understanding of the calling process is that a member of the Quorum of the 12 actually goes into a room, I think like once a week, and they have applications and pictures of the folks who have sent in their paperwork, along with like needs around the world, and the apostle will sort of like say, okay, this person should go there, this person should go there, and they issue the callings that way. I don't know for sure that that's true, but I can't remember the source where I read that. Josh, have you heard something similar though about that process?
Right. So I think that's pretty accurate, but I think they also delegate it too. Like they hand that off to other people. Yeah, I think so. Just because there's so many of them, I don't see them doing that every day, all day. So.
Well, now I'm mad because I thought it was like special. Dang it. Maybe mine was special. I don't know about yours, Josh, but mine was.
There's no way to tell, but they have 50 to 80,000 missionaries out at any given time. So.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a great point. That would be probably a full-time job in and of itself. You know, you're right.
Right.
You delegate that, I'm sure. So, anyway, so I served, in Bulgaria, and I was like super excited. I remember when I got my mission calls, and then it comes in like this packet in the mail, you know, and it's like a big old packet, and it has like the return address of the church, and you're just like, oh, this is it. Like, this is where I'm going to be. And it's a big deal. Like, people will wait till their entire family can get together. And I don't know. I didn't do that. I ran to my parents' house. I was living on campus at Utah State, and my parents lived in Providence, which is nearby, very close. And I got the mail that went to my parents' house. And then I went home and I was like, I'm not waiting for anyone. So I'm just going to call whoever's available and I'm just going to open this up right now. And I didn't know like where Bulgaria was or what it was. I think I knew it was in Europe, but I'm not 100% sure. Now that I think about it, I can't remember for sure if I knew that or not. And yeah, so then you go to the missionary training center for a couple of months if you're learning a language. So I entered the MTC in December of 2002, actually. So very, very end of 2002. Spent a couple months there, and then actually ended up waiting for my visa for like 1 month in like Colby, Kansas, of all random places, but then ended up serving for, you know, a good 12 to 13 months in Bulgaria, or not 12 to 13, I mean like 15 or so, 13 to 15 months in Bulgaria, and had just a, you know, it was hard. It was a very grueling experience in many ways, but I still look back on it with a lot of fondness and made some very good friends and had some pretty pivotal experiences, but it was very different from what you were describing, Katie and Zach, just in the sense that it's, you know, it's proselyting, like, all day, every day. It's knocking on doors, it's stopping people on the street, it's talking to people on buses, it's handing out copies of the Book of Mormon to, like, strangers. It's thinking of funny or interesting or, you know, unique ways that you can get into doors, and share, fairly, kind of standardized message. So in that way, it was, you know, pretty different, I think, from what I heard you guys sharing about. But certainly a rite of passage and a growing experience. So.
Right. So in the LDS church for young men, it's an expectation. Like, you're seen as less than if you don't go. I think by the time you're older in life, like if you're in your 50s or 60s, you can redeem yourself if you didn't go. But yeah, definitely when you're younger, if you haven't served a mission, you're definitely seen as something different, I guess. If you come home early within that 2 years, like you just couldn't cut it, or if you even had health, like legitimate health issues, you'll be ostracized for that too. So you do everything you possibly can to stay the whole time. That was definitely the case for me, because like within the first 6 months, I wanted to come home pretty bad, but I knew that wasn't an option because I would just be ostracized from my, well, they call them wards. So ward would be the congregation. So I served in Mexico, Tampico. Like you, Katie, I didn't wait for my whole family to get home. It was just my mom at home, and I just decided to open it, and I read Mexico, Tampico, and I ended up, that scared me more than anything, because I knew I had to learn another language. And so, yeah, we didn't know the language going into it, most of us. We learned while we were out there, and that was really difficult, just to try to get people baptized, not even having mastered the language yet. And then having to report back to district leaders and zone leaders all your numbers, as far as like how many discussions did you teach, how many commitments to baptism did you give, how many baptisms for the month did you have, etc. So yeah, it's tough, and it really does have awesome experiences, but portion of it's really, really grueling, like you said.
Did you want to go initially, Josh? And then when you got out there, you were like, oh, I don't know about this. Or were you like not super stoked about going in the first place?
So I talked about this just on my episode that aired last week, but I went when I was 21. So I went from 2003 to 2005. And yeah, I went to the MTC the day after I turned 21. At first, when I was out of high school, I didn't want to go, but then I had a coming to God moment, I suppose, where I got my life in order, worked 6 months to get myself out there, and I really wanted to go. But by the time I got out there, just being introverted and learning a new language and not having anybody to speak English with, that's when it was like, what did I get myself into? But it definitely got better a year into it, and when I was more culturally acclimated and could understand what people were saying to me, and I could speak back to them. So
like just a really tough, you know, first, well, it sounds like first year or so, but then it kind of got better for your second year.
Right. Yeah. I just had to learn how to work my own groove and not worry about numbers so much, because that was always really tough on us, is like the expectations that were always put on us of the numbers that we'd have to report back. Yeah. There's just a point of shame. Like if you didn't have a baptism, or especially in like Latin America, if you weren't baptizing people, is a point of shame.
Yeah. Boy, that wasn't quite my experience in Bulgaria. Right. Excited if you even like had an investigator. But I think that's just a big cultural difference, you know. I think altogether I don't think I had any investigator that I like taught like from beginning to end, you know, that ended up getting baptized. I think I had a handful here or there that I had a hand in, but there wasn't that, you know, experience of this is the person that I found and then taught and then brought to baptism or anything like that. I didn't have that at all on my mission.
Yeah, okay. Right. Europe is definitely tougher for LDS missionaries.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly, I think, the I think the church in general, not now I'm speaking of the sort of the Christian church, not the LDS church in particular, the church in general is, you know, is kind of waning, I guess you could say, in Europe. So.
Right.
I mean, Katie and Zach, like, hearing us sort of reflect a little bit, like, what questions or thoughts or anything comes to your mind as you hear that?
You know, one of the questions that just popped into my mind as Josh was talking was, how do you pay for that? Who pays for that? Going on a mission in the LDS church.
So in the LDS church, the expectation is the individual family or missionary will pay for it. And the whole thing, it's $400 a month for American missionaries. It's different for different countries. Like, I know that was not an expectation for my companions that were from Mexico. They definitely weren't paying that or anything at all. So, any missionary that can fund their own way, it's an expectation. And if you can't, then they have allocated funds that are coming from a ward level, which would be the congregation itself. If the congregation can't meet those needs, then it's met by the church itself.
Yeah. So that would be a difference. I don't have the cost right in front of me. When I did World Service Corps, you pay $750 just up front, and then World Service Corps covers your plane ticket, and you get a stipend for living expenses such as, you know, food, toiletries, depending on where you're at, maybe even a little money to help supplement or support your host family where you're staying. Because in World Service Corps, you stay with a family. It's not a separate house or a separate place or anything. And then the long term, when you go on a long term experience with World Service Corps, I think it's like $1,200 or something like that.
It's actually $800 for short term and $1,000 for long term.
Well, I was close. I was close. but long term, actually, you get a living allowance or a stipend. So you actually kind of get paid to do it. And then we also, they also do a kind of an intern program. And that's a little different, but that also is a stipend experience as well. So that would be a little bit of a difference there.
That's very interesting. I know, I don't think my family paid for my entire mission. I know I didn't. I didn't have any, like a lot of, especially boys, I would say, growing up LDS, there's this sort of expectation that you, if you get a job before you serve a mission, and so, you know, that's like when you're 18 or 19, so if you get a job and you're like 16, 17, 18, whatever, it's sort of the expectation is you have that job because you're like saving for your mission. For girls, that's not so much a thing, so I actually don't even know how my mission was paid for all the way.
Yeah, mine was paid for from my, when my grandma passed away in 2002. My parents got the inheritance money out between the siblings. My parents used that money to pay for me.
Katie and Zach, like, about how, what percentage would you say of, say, Community of Christ youth do World Service Corps?
A pretty small percentage. Each year total, I would say it's approximately 20 to 30 young adults.
Oh, wow.
That's for the short term. And then maybe for long term, a dozen or so.
It's pretty small.
Yeah. It's nowhere near 50 to 80,000, that's for sure.
And I think it's also, there's that difference in expectation as well. That it's really not something that you're expected to do in the church. It's just available as an option if you want to continue to explore Community of Christ in different cultures. And it's also, in some ways, a leadership development opportunity for you to learn more about the church and learn more about yourself and continue to grow as a minister.
Yeah, I think that's a really significant part, is that it really isn't an expectation at all. In fact, World Service Corps is there for experience. I mean, it's not there as a obligation of discipleship or membership. It's not there as a necessary tool for the church. It's there really as an opportunity to experience the world through a Community of Christ lens. It would be interesting to see the numbers on this. I don't know them, but I would imagine that even though that number is a small number, there's probably a decent percentage of people that have done World Service Corps end up working for Community of Christ.
I can see that.
The reason is because it is a leadership development and experiential program that really, you know, and I can speak for myself and for Katie, I mean, really does change your life and your kind of paradigm on how you see things. So that would be a real stark contrast to the missionary program in the LDS Church, is that it's really not there to grow the church as much as it is to expand the mission of the church. And when I say mission of the church, I mean that intangible stuff of modeling Jesus. And that's kind of sometimes hard to quantify and put statistics and analysis to, but you get a real experience of encountering God in unique and profound ways, going into cross-cultural experiences, not with the burden of, you don't report to anyone when you're on World Service Corps. You don't have the burden of meeting, you know, data points or anything like that. Your burden is having these crazy experiences in these other countries. So
I will say that there is accountability. So even though there aren't those same expectations, you know, the World Service Corps director will meet with you frequently just to make sure that everything's going well and that it's a good fit. And there's the hope that you'll be contributing something of meaning.
Wow. So you would say, I'm curious, is there, is it like a very competitive process then, or is it just sort of the folks who seem led to it tend to go and, you know, if you feel sort of called in that direction, there's a spot for you?
I think it's both and.
Okay.
I mean, obviously I'm not the director of the program, so I don't know, but,
right.
You know, not everyone who applies gets in. And that's okay. Due to a number of, you know, circumstances, whether that's, personal issues and availability of sites and, you know, capacity to host people. But there's definitely a desire, if there's the capacity, to host folks. So, you know, it is competitive in that not everyone gets in, but it's also a graceful process. You know, it's not competitive in the sense that there's like punitive, you know, you're not good enough to go kind of thing.
Right.
So that's kind of why I say both and.
But there also needs to be some sense of basic cultural sensitivity to be able to be effective in different contexts.
Right. So is there any like sort of training before you go to say, hey, don't go slap the statue or?
Yeah. You know, that when you were talking, Josh, earlier, and actually Katie, you as well, I was kind of chuckling because you said you spent 2 months in the MTC getting ready for this experience. Most World Service Corps representatives spend about a week in intensive training before they go out. Now, obviously, there's a big difference. You were gone for 15 months. We're gone for 10 weeks.
Right.
So, you know, there is that kind of relativity to that. But yeah, it's typically a week long of intensive training where you go over theology, you go over cultural context for each site. You get some of that sensitivity training, you get some of that pastoral training, and things of that nature.
Boy, I don't remember getting any cultural sensitivity training. How about you, Josh?
No, I didn't. It was just all theology, just how to teach people.
Mm-hmm. Right, and language, yeah.
I'll share
an embarrassing story that from my mission, you know, I remember we had this family that was just super gracious and generous to us. It was, they weren't really very interested in becoming Mormons, but they liked us and we liked them. And it was a lot better than knocking on doors. And you got to count the discussions as well. And I'm making it sound, more crass than I mean. It was a very sweet relationship that we had with this family. They were lovely, lovely people. And we had a very genuine warmth, you know, between us. Anyway, I remember it was Christmas time and we were Americans and we're used to lavishing presents on each other around Christmas time, you know? And so my companion and I were like, oh my gosh, we're going to like save our money this month and we'll buy these guys like awesome presents and it'll be so great, you know? And so we did. We bought them all like a very thoughtful, sort of personal, like quite nice gift, you know? And I remember they were so embarrassed by it. And in particular, I remember that we gave the dad this nice necktie. And he was like, where am I ever going to wear this? Like, he had no place to wear it because he was like a blue-collar working kind of guy, you know? He didn't have a dress shirt, and yet we'd bought him a tie. And I remember then they felt obligated to reciprocate, but they didn't have a lot of money, so they bought us like soap, which was wonderful and beautiful after we had given them these like fairly nice gifts. And I remember just thinking like, oh man, I was very embarrassed because I realized that we had sort of done Christmas our way and had not even stopped to think about how do they do Christmas, you know? Because the Bulgarians don't do Christmas the consumeristic American way. And it created some sort of strange social imbalances there that we had tried to kind of impose our consumerism and materialism and wealth into this, you know, into this sort of dynamic that we had with the family. So that's sort of one experience where I kind of think, ugh, you know, I wish someone had talked to us a little bit about that kind of stuff before we went in country.
And you were well intended too. That's the thing.
Oh, for sure. We were like so well intended. We were like ridiculously earnest, you know.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, even though we received cultural sensitivity training, we all mess up, you know, and I had a couple of experiences in Zambia where, you know, I thought I was fighting for justice or doing the right thing. And it was just culturally inappropriate. So we'll give you some grace because it just happens.
Well, and I think that's probably true. One of the things that these experiences have in common, kind of regardless of the intention. When you go somewhere and experience a different culture, I feel like you always leave with a larger understanding of the world. Whether that comes from learning from doing things the wrong way or learning from observing people their way. And I definitely had both of those experiences in India. I think that whenever you live in a different culture for a while, it changes how you see yourself in relationship to the world.
Yes.
I fully agree.
Absolutely.
So why don't we have you, Katie, talk about your time in India, just some of the memorable experiences, how long you were there, etc.
Well, I was in India for about 6 weeks. It was a shorter trip. And I was in two primary locations. I was in Uttamapalayam and Pradipadu. In those locations, there's tons of little Community of Christ churches out in these villages, in the hillsides. And we would every single day, get in the car and just drive all over India to visit these little village churches. And sometimes we would teach classes. We had our papers on the enduring principles. So that was an opportunity to just talk about and teach about the beliefs of the church. And a lot of times it was preaching, and most commonly it was just simply sharing together in meals and learning about the life experiences of people in the villages. There were times when it felt really busy and full, and there were other times when the days were pretty idle. And we had to come up with creative ways to pass the time. But overall, it was one of the most transformative experiences of my life, to be able to work side by side with really capable, gifted ministers in the church in India who I'm still friends with today. So, I think it was really eye-opening seeing how Community of Christ is truly a diverse international body, diverse in not just in terms of culture, but also at times in terms of the way that we talk about our beliefs and the way that we understand our theology. So it was pretty eye-opening for me to see that my church could look very different somewhere else, and yet I could still find a part in it.
Right. So what would you say are some of the beliefs that would be different for them?
Well, I think in some places in India, I certainly don't want to overgeneralize, there was a strong influence of evangelical Christian culture that permeated the village setting. And so there's often, I think, confusion about Christianity in terms of denominationalism at times, and maybe even understanding what church you're actually a part of. But then there were also some pretty Pentecostal moments that took me by surprise. So it just kind of depended on where we were. A lot of the villages were very different. Some you could tell were much more distinctly Community of Christ, and others that maybe weren't visited as often, or were newer to the church, you could tell had influences from different types of Christianity. But, you know, another interesting thing about India is that Christianity is not the majority religion. And so there were some places where we met in secret, and where there was fear of violence against Christians in those areas. And so there were even a couple of baptisms and confirmations where we had to be really secretive about it because there was a fear that family members might find out and it could be destructive to those families. So, it, you know, very interesting situation to be in a culture where you're not the majority religion.
So one thing that I'm curious about then, you know, you talk about some of the congregations that were possibly more remote or newer or something like that, and they and you might not immediately know even that they were Community of Christ. You know, did those folks, I mean, and I guess it sort of depends, my understanding is it sort of depends from congregation to congregation anyway, like the extent to which some of the restoration distinctives are emphasized in a given congregation anyway. But like, say for example, would those folks, did they even know like that the church accepted the Book of Mormon or those kinds of things? Was that on their radar or not so much?
Well, I don't think I could answer for all of them. I do think that for the congregations that are kind of, you know, the core Community of Christ congregations, there is definitely an understanding of that. But I'm not sure how much of a connection there would be to the broader restoration tradition. That wasn't at the forefront when we were there and talking with people.
Yeah.
But, you know, in a lot of village settings, I think that when I went over there, I cared a lot about right theology. And I had to be confronted in my theology police nature in some ways, just because I started to realize how in a lot of village settings, you know, after we would be done preaching or sharing in whatever way, there would often be a line of people that would be asking for prayer for all different kinds of things, sick family members, sick cows, sick goats, and I had to come to terms with what it meant to offer prayer for all of those different types of things. But also, I realized that my theology had been shaped really in a culture of privilege. And I was now in a place where theology was an everyday reality of survival. And so that definitely changed the way that I understood my place in my tradition. And it, I mean, it impacted the way that I view how we live our theology in general. But in terms of specifically connecting to the restoration tradition, I'm not sure how much a part of that was there. I don't know that most of the villages would be able to tell you about our history. But I know that there was a deep desire for God as an urgent reality in everyday life.
Yeah, boy, that resonates a lot with me, what you're saying. And like, I don't know, Josh, if you had this same sort of experience, but I look back and I know hindsight is 2020, and obviously I'm not the same person now that I was then, but that what you said, Katie, about the right theology, and, you know, I wish someone had confronted me, you know, I wish that had been a thing. I wish that I was so worried. I just think back on all of the beautiful people that I met and the wonderful experiences that I had with folks who, the vast, vast majority of whom had zero interest whatsoever in, like, converting to my faith tradition. And I was so anxious for them too, that I'm not saying I always missed opportunities for real connection, because I think that there were plenty of times where God's grace does, you know, did what God's grace does, which is to forge connections and to find love and to find the space, between. But there were times too that I think I was closed off to it because I was just so focused on my message being heard that I did not realize that I had so much to learn from them about what faith is. Like, even right now, like, I'm taking a class in seminary on church history, and my professor is a Coptic nun, which, you know, that's an Eastern Orthodox, church, and the Bulgarians are Eastern Orthodox, and I'm learning all about Orthodox theology, and it's beautiful. And the tradition is beautiful, and it's actually quite distinct and quite different from the West in really quite intriguing and lovely ways. And I'm like, man, I was right there. You know, I wish I had the presence of mind to be less concerned about my own message and instead to interact more with what was there to learn. So.
Right. Yeah. I totally missed out a lot of things too. So I was really interested when I was in Huautla, the state of Hidalgo, Mexico. There's a lot of people there from the ranches that spoke Nahuatl, and that's like the Aztec language. And I really was interested in that, but I just didn't have time to actually engage with it or learn it. And there's other interests of mine that I just didn't have time to, because we weren't there to learn from them as an LDS. I guess that's just the point when you're trying to convert the world. There's a sort of, and I'm not trying to be overly negative, it's just the nature of the beast, but there's a slight cultural imperialism to it when you're trying to bring them to your message versus learning from them. But yeah, when we were teaching people, if they weren't receptive to wanting to get baptized in Mexico, we would call them anzuelos, which is like fish hook. Like, they're just there to reel you in and waste your time, and you have to cut them loose.
Oh, man.
Which is really, really negative. Right. But, yeah, we were there to teach people. This is a talk about a few of the positive things, because I don't want to leave only negative things about my mission, because it wasn't my personal relationship with Christ. The way I understood Jesus Christ back then was very different, but it was really important to me. We had to testify a lot about Joseph Smith and the origins of the LDS faith, and none of that really spoke to my heart as much as just testifying about God's unconditional love for people that could be made possible through Jesus. And that's how I understood it at the time, through the atonement theology, right? So back then, I even, on my mission, took the time to write a small book about Jesus Christ's atonement. So yeah, that was what was meaningful for me. It was just testifying to people. And I remember one of the guys that I taught towards the end, it had nothing to do with LDS church, and he ended up being baptized, but it was just his personal, because he felt worthless, and I just told him that through Christ, you're worth everything, you know. So those are the memorable things for me,
you know. Not to interject, I was just thinking, you know, Josh, I don't think I uttered the name Joseph Smith while I was doing World Service Corps.
Right, and I wouldn't imagine you would, probably. So do you want to talk about your experience, Zach?
Yeah, I can. So you just need to know, I can get really preachy about it, because it was a really profound experience in my life. And, you know, and I'm a 70 in the church. So if I, you know, if I'm rambling on, well, I'm sure my wife will look at me like, okay, stop. But also, you should both feel free to just say, please stop talking. We need to go to bed or whatever. So I'll try to kind of just condense it. I spent 10 weeks in Zambia, Africa, and kind of toured all around that country, visiting a lot of our congregations in that area. The Community of Christ has a fairly strong, well, I would call at the time, and obviously I'm speaking from my experience, not on behalf of the church here, but had a fairly strong expression of Community of Christ in Zambia. I spent a lot of my time in a small village called Kashakishi, in the northern part of Zambia, no electricity, no water. And it was the toughest time in my life. Most every day, was just spent surviving. You wake up, you go down, you get water from the well, you come back, you make breakfast, you clean up breakfast. And by the time you've done all that, it's time for lunch. You make lunch, you clean up lunch. And by the time you've done that, you have to do laundry. And by the time you've done that, the sun is going down. It's time for dinner. You do dinner, you clean up dinner, and then there's no electricity. So it's dark. You maybe turn on a candle and read for a few minutes, and then you go to bed because you're exhausted. I mean, you know, so that was like, that was a day. And, so in the days that we weren't traveling to congregations or visiting with members of the church, or with community folks, it was exhausting. It was tiring. But the most profound thing, and I think if you asked anyone from Zambia, they would say the same, that I learned and gained so much more than I gave, in my experience. And, I really, in every sense of it, I met Jesus, in Africa. I encountered the living Christ in the midst of the world's poorest people. And it was life changing. I mean, to the point where it changed everything I look at, everything I eat, everything I think about. I mean, I now have a different lens in which I see the world, because of that experience. So it was just a really powerful, and profound opportunity to get to experience such a unique, such a radically different place in the world, in the way the church is there, in the way the church works there. It's really amazing in that culture to go to church and women are 100% treated equal and a part of the ministry, but yet as soon as church is over, because of the culture, they go right back into gender roles and what's acceptable and what's not. So when you're in church, those fade away. And when you're out of church, those come right back. That was really a unique experience for me. But I could sit here and go on and on about, you know, really individual experiences that caused that to be so profound for me. But in a lot of ways, I can honestly tell the both of you and everyone listening, I would not be doing what I'm doing today or who I am today without that experience. I think that's what really, really called me into discipleship. And so for that, I'm deeply, deeply grateful for an experience like that to change my life and to call attention to justice in the world, to call attention to the need for the world to change, to heal some of the suffering, inequity in our world. All of that comes from my experience as a 21-year-old guy in Zambia, Africa. And so, you know, all of that is why I serve the church in North America and want to see the world change through faith so that the hungry are fed, so that the naked are clothed, so that the homeless find shelter. All of that is because I met Jesus in one of the world's poorest places through World Service Corps. So, If I don't stop, I'm going to just keep going and I'm going to start throwing scripture in here in a second. So that's a little bit.
We better not hear that.
Right. Right. We got to cut it before I take you all to church.
I'll just add to that real quick too and say, I think what was so profound for me going into, a lot of villages where there was, you know, pretty extreme poverty was that these were my sisters and brothers in Christ. And waking up to the reality that when we talk about abolishing poverty and ending suffering in Community of Christ, we're not talking about an abstract problem that is separate from us. And it brings new meaning to the phrase, for in their welfare resides your welfare. And so it was a wake-up call to the ways that we're connected in the issues of justice and peace in our world.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
They're just, you know, in our conversation, I've just been sitting here thinking, you know, in some ways these experiences are comparable, but in a lot of ways, you know, we're talking about oranges and apples. They're just very, very different things. And I think part of that is because our churches are just very different. And that's, and I don't say that in a negative way. I don't think that's a negative thing. It's just that we just have very different ways of expressing our encounter, and encounters with God and Christ in the world. And so, of course, those are going to be expressed in unique ways, individual to those faiths. So, as we've talked, I just keep thinking how different these experiences and opportunities are.
Yeah, they are. They really are. And yet, I would say too that, like, I don't know about if Josh, if you would say the same thing about your mission, but I do feel like my mission was very formative for me. There were a lot of things that were super hard about it. I had really bad anxiety on my mission. Really, really struggled with that a lot. And it did not help my severe case of perfectionism too much with all those
right
stuff.
Exactly.
But at the same time, you know, the things that, that Katie and Zach shared about encountering Christ, I look back on it now through the lens of the journey that I've, you know, been on for the past 10 years or so, and the place where I am now moving into a call to public ministry and that sort of thing. And I look back on that and I just see over and over and over again where I encountered God and where God was in the people and in the homes and on the streets and just everywhere. And I went through a period of time for several years where I really resented my mission. I had a lot of anger when I would think about it. I don't feel that way though anymore. I look back on it and I'm not saying that it was paradise, because I know that it was painful and it was really hard. But I do know, like, I can say for sure that God was there, and I can say for sure that it really shaped me and made me into someone who wants to connect with people and who wants to talk about these important things, who wants to open dialogues and discussions and to find meaningful connection. And maybe it taught me a few ways not to do that. But then I also learned some really powerful and important ways too. To just listen, you know, when in those moments when I did just listen, in those moments when I did just sit and be present instead of trying to, like, you know, say my side. They're some of the most, like, sacred and profound experiences I've ever had. So, I mean, I think there's something about being in different cultural contexts, which I know not all LDS missionaries get. You know, some of them are in their own cultural context, which I'm sure it carries its own gifts and challenges, but there's something unique about being in a different cultural context that sort of brings that out and separates that period of time as a very, like, you know, unique and definite sort of period or time of life. So that's sort of, looking back on it now, what I kind of take away and how I think back on it. How about you, Josh? You think back on your mission and, you know, what are the takeaways that you have, both positive and negative, that you bring forward with you into your life now?
Yeah, I shared a few of them already. It's just basically the things that are the most meaningful to me, teaching people the things that have helped me. I still carry that forward. It was really informative for me too. I can't play the game of sliding doors to say where I'd be without it. My guess is I would not be nearly as involved with religion in general, but that's impossible to say exactly where I'd be at if I didn't go. But yeah, it was formative for me as well. And I, just listening to Katie and Zach, I'd like that experience of the dualistic approach of being student and teacher at the same time, you know, so where you're not just trying to teach people correct way of thinking, but also learn from them, just knowing that with their culture, they have things that they have insights that they could teach you as well.
Well, you and Brittany will have to do one later. That'd be awesome.
It's a possibility.
You know, I also think to compare the experiences. I remember when I was sitting on the plane heading to India all by myself, and I was just thinking, when did I get this brave to take this huge risk of going to this place that I've never been before, where I don't know anyone and I have no idea what it's going to be like? And I think anytime we take a risk like that in life, it strengthens something within us. And so regardless of the intention that sends us into these crazy adventures around the world, I think that they are incredibly formative, and I'm grateful for that formation in whatever way it comes.
Right. I agree with you.
Cool. Well, thank you all so much. It's been just a wonderful experience talking with each of you, and sort of the chance to compare and contrast a little bit, and to hear little snippets of what each of us sort of took away from our experiences. And we hope that listeners, you have also enjoyed sharing this time with us. And feel free to come over to projectzionpodcast.org and share, you know, your mission experiences or your World Service Corps experiences, if you've had them, and, you know, continue the dialogue there. Thank you so much for listening to Project Zion.
Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ. The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ.